ultrasonic will be at the altitude of the ionosphere, it should show the signs of malfunction. Back to you.
Okay, so your airplanes, your balloons, nothing except a rocket can get anywhere near 60 miles up. In fact, I think the definition of space is roughly 60 miles. I think it's 60 kilometers, it's 100 kilometers. 100 kilometers is the current definition of space, which is somewhere around 60 miles, 62 miles. So the ionosphere is at the threshold of space. It's also above the mesosphere, I think they call it. The scientists who study the ionosphere and above, they call it the ignorosphere, because until recently, not many people have paid much attention to what goes on up there. As far as ultraviolet exposure to living biological organisms on the Earth, the ionosphere is very important, because the total ultraviolet output from the sun is quite lethal to life. The ionosphere is a shield, and anything that interferes with that shield will eventually interfere with human health. That's the reason why chlorofluorocarbons, your freon materials, have become illegal, because each freon molecule is capable of deionizing a significant number of ionospheric particles. Each molecule of chlorofluorocarbon can do that. So we have to stop releasing chlorofluorocarbons, freons. We have to stop releasing freons into the atmosphere, because it was significantly destroying the ozone layer, the ionosphere. And that's very important. And so that's why it became illegal. That's why there was the Kyoto Agreement on that particular one, and we finally started really honoring it. For the time being, if you and I want to buy Freon 14, they have made it extremely expensive, and you're going to be very discouraged from buying very much of it. And you no longer use it to refrigerate your automobiles. You're using a much lower efficiency material, but...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Until recently, I had an older automobile where I was maintaining the air conditioning system that ran on Freon 14, and I could no longer obtain the material. And thank goodness, for a bunch of other reasons, I had to give up on that particular automobile. So, the ozone layer, the ionosphere, protects us from ultraviolet. The sun is significantly putting out a lot of ultraviolet continuously. It's a conducting medium. It's a conducting medium like a resistor. You apply voltage across the resistor, you get current, you get heat.
That means, but I wanted to hear for yes or no. If electronic, for any reason, was at that level, at that medium, should that electronic show signs of malfunction?
Would my electronics work correctly in the ionosphere? Absolutely. If that's what you're asking.
Okay, we have a conductive medium that could be ionized or changed or alternated by the radio waves from the HARP system, but at the same time, the electronic that is at that level, at that conductive medium, would not affect the electronics, would not be affected.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. The air around you right now is an extremely high resistance material. You and I can easily build an electroscope, an electrostatic sensing device. I can easily measure that when I go into a great big open field like the schoolyard near you, I can easily confirm that the E field from Earth toward the sky is approximately 100 volts per meter. But that air is such an extremely high resistive material that your body is a perfect short circuit to it. Your head ordinarily would be 200 volts more positive than your feet. Because your body is so conductive, your head is more positive than your feet by a microvolt. I'm picking numbers out of the air, but I might be approximately right. It's a very small difference. Although the ionosphere is maybe 1,000 times more conductive than the air in your backyard, it is still an extremely resistive material. It takes cubic miles of that ionosphere to give you the significant reflection in order for you to make 20-meter contacts. It's a very low density material. It's conductive, It's a hell of a lot more conductive than the air, but it's extremely low conductivity because the spacing between those ozone layer, those ozone molecules, is extremely large by standard temperature pressure consideration. So you think your electronics going up there is going to experience a short circuit. If you had extremely high impedance electronics made out of FET transistors, yes, they would experience some difference in performance. But you and I would be smart enough to put a shield around that circuit. I mean, almost everything you and I build in electronics has a box around it, a metallic box, the shield, the grounding, and whatever. And as such, it would have no trouble operating in the ionosphere. Your antenna could operate...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Down on Earth, your dipole, think it sees an impedance of 377 ohms. If I raise your dipole on a rocket ship to 60 miles, I'm in the middle of the ionosphere, and I operate my dipole, I'm picking numbers out of the air, but instead of seeing 377 ohms per square of local impedance, I'm going to see 375. I'm going to see a slightly more conducting medium, if you know what I mean. The conducting, the amount of conduction of that ionosphere, relatively speaking, is high compared to ordinary air. It's extremely low to anything you and I call conductor, and making contact to it, therefore, is very difficult. And
how would you measure the square mile of the ionosphere in terms of energy? And what what measurement would you use for it? Would that be volts, columns, or how would you actually try to find out one square, or maybe one cubic of mile of the ionosphere in terms of energy?
If I want to measure the properties of the ionosphere, and I care about a cubic mile of it, all I've got to do is measure a cubic centimeter of it, assume it's uniform, and it's close to true. The device that you use on a weather balloon called Ionosound makes electronic measurements of the air layer it is driving through. So as that weather balloon goes up in the air and it's trailing that thing below it, a chunk of electronics called Ionosound, it measures, you could say, 1 cubic centimeter of the air, and measure is electrical properties, dielectric strength, frequency of resonance, whatever, as it rises. Unfortunately, you can't make a balloon go to 60 miles, but if you could, you could make a measurement of 1 cubic centimeter, assume the all the ionosphere is a reasonable uniform, and you could therefore speculate what a cubic mile of it looks like.
And what is the measurement factor that you utilize for that?
The Ionosound makes a whole lot of measurements. One of them is it has a carefully constructed oscillator, and as the local air goes through it, has a certain moisture content, for instance, because moisture aerosols, little particles of water, have a dielectric constant of 81, which makes the frequency of resonance go down, and you measure the moisture content. That's just one of many measurements you can measure with an Ionosound. We're about to run out of time. I'm going to go a little bit further, but not very much. This was TechNet number 1,329. You and I are going to go a little bit further. Anyone else, if they want to listen, it's up to them. Another crazy TechNet, but I think we've covered some area. I wonder if Mel wants to say a few words before we officially close down, but I'm going to go a little bit further. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very interesting as always, enjoy it as always, and I think we had a very good, successful night. We answered everybody's questions. I'm sure I'll get some good feedback via internet that we're doing the right job now, finally, hopefully, to satisfy everybody. So with that, I'm going to thank everybody that joins us, all those that listen in. I hope you've all had a Merry Christmas. And, of course, have a very happy, healthy New Year coming up, and we'll look forward to doing it again. Keep it up, New Year coming, and so we'll keep the TechNet coming, I hope, Dick. I hope you agree with us. 73 call. This is K2KEY.
A comment from Mel, Zek WN.
You got it, Paul.
Yeah, Mel. Just want to mention the your club page. What is it, King County Association? Very good with the poem. They've got a poem on a ham for Christmas. Pretty good. From I guess another ham or something that wrote that.
That can measure the amount of ionization
of your particular cubic centimeter of the ionosphere. You and I could build a chunk of electronics that we put it on a rocket, we fly the rocket up at 60 miles, it opens up the chamber, it gathers a cubic centimeter of the ionosphere and makes a measurement. That's one possible way of doing it. An ionosound below a weather balloon at much lower altitudes makes measurements that are more appropriate for allowing you to predict the weather. You want to know the moisture content, the temperature, the air pressure, and so on. So an ionosound makes various measurements, and you and I could devise electronics that would work not at 6 miles, but works at 60 miles. And that ionosphere is a conducting volumetric medium, and its amount of conduction by comparison to the normal resistors.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Compared to the resistors you and I can put on the table, and we put our two probes of our volt ohm millimeter across it, or our digital voltmeter, the ionosphere is an extremely low conducting material. In the case of that automatic leveling device that was done by Maynard Hill for controlling model airplanes using the E field of 200 volts per meter down at Earth level, in order for him to measure the amount of voltage between the air that's 1 foot higher than a chunk of air that's 1 foot lower. In other words, his airplane is rolled a little bit so that the left-hand wing is 1 foot higher than the tip of the right-hand wing. In order for him to make that measurement, he had to grab onto a great big volume of that air. But he could do that with a great big metallic sphere mounted at the tip of the airplane, but that would create so much drag that the airplane wouldn't fly very well. He did the electronic equivalent by placing a polonium source near the tip of the left-hand wingtip and another polonium source near the tip of the right-hand wingtip. That polonium source was giving off a lot of nuclear radiation. Let me drop. The nuclear radiation given off by that polonium source on the left wingtip and the right wingtip ionized a great big ball of air near the left-hand wingtip and a great big ball of air near the right-hand wingtip. And from each of the metallic structures of those polonium sources, those two wires came into a high impedance operational amplifier, and he measured the voltage difference between the left-hand source and the right-hand source. He had the equivalent of a great big metal sphere by ionizing the air, but because the air was still free to move, it wasn't creating drag for the airplane. The airplane would fly, but he had the equivalent of a great big metallic sphere grabbing onto this very highly resistive material and measure the voltage difference across it. You and I could devise circuitry to do that in the ionosphere. We could measure the conduction of the ionosphere by making an ohm meter. I could literally have two polonium sources on the left-hand edge and the right-hand edge of a one-meter stick, and I put my ohm meter between the two. I now am measuring the resistivity of that chunk of ionosphere that's in the vicinity of my my 1 meter stick. I just pulled that one out of the air, but it's just a guess as to how you and I could start making a measurement of the characteristics of that ionosphere. I could measure ionospheric resistivity with that instrumentation. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, you're actually giving me, guys, the best possible present for end of the year by going deep into the subject. What I hate is just something you started and never finished. And you both put a lot of effort into getting into the details. Anybody who was listening to that explanation, which actually was followed by the questions of mine, yes, I admit I was playing devil's advocate. Some of the information I completely know what would be the answer, but I wanted to hear from you. So I do very much appreciate and thank you for your work. Glenn Pickup.
It's funny. I'm out there and I'm out there with the HT coming back inside here. It's still kind of like digging out the walkways. I'm just trying to make sure I don't get snowed in here. But always a pleasure to hear you on, Wesley and Dick. Another very, very successful TechNet, and it's always enjoying for me to listen in and join and help wherever I can. But let me wish everybody a happy and healthy new year. I'm not signing out, but I'm kind of running back and forth with the shovel to make sure that I don't get snowed in. So let me pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm going to make a very rough order of magnitude guess here, Wesley. I've got two polonium sauces, one on each tip of a 1 meter wooden meter stick. And if I put a high impedance voltmeter from the wires coming from each of those two polonium sauces that are on the tip of the 1 meter stick, I can easily measure the local E field that's down here on Earth. And a buddy of mine did that, and I saw that experiment. Works like a charm. What he did was to connect the output of the amplifier into a zero center milliammeter, which he mounted in the middle of the yardstick. As he tilted the yardstick down to the left, the needle would move to the right. As he tilted the yardstick down to the right, the centimeter milliammeter would move to the left.
Absolutely amazing.
When he had it set up just right, it was amazing. The needle would always stick, the needle on the milliammeter would always stick straight up as he tilted his yardstick left and right. When he did it outdoors, when he did it inside the building, nothing happened, if you know what I mean. So he could measure the local E field. Now, he could have, if he wanted to, let me drop. In theory, he could have put his ohm meter, a real good high quality ohm meter, between those two wires instead of the amplifier. And I think down at Earth level, he would have measured many gigohms, many billions of ohms. If you and I took that yardstick with that ohm meter and we raised it at 60 miles on our rocket ship, instead of measuring gigohms, I am guessing you would measure megohms. In other words, I am guessing that you and I would be able to confirm with that simple experiment that the ionosphere is more than 1,000 and maybe it's 10,000 times more conductive than the air at sea level on a normal day with normal humidity. So I'm making a guess. So the ionosphere is extremely conductive, thousands and maybe 10,000 and maybe 100,000 times more conductive as an ionizing medium than air. But still the impedance between those two probes is probably going to be megohms. So it's kind of relative, if you know what I mean. A naive person would think, gee, the ionosphere is a conducting medium. It's going to make a short circuit to all my electronics that I behave in that I try to operate in that area that's not shielded. I don't think it's quite like that. Your and my radio signal is bouncing off many square miles of that ionosphere. So what's going on in square miles is what's counting, and you and I could make a measurement across 1 meter of it, but it would have to be pretty sensitive instrumentation, in my opinion. Those are some guesses, but you and I now know what to look for. We read about ionosounds. We could read about Pioneer. I can't think of the name of the very first satellite the United States launched, but it reconfirmed the presence of the Van Allen belt. It was really measuring the ionosphere, in my opinion. One more drop. One more thing I'm going to tell you. When it comes to measuring the ionosphere, the company that I worked for, Airborne Instrument Laboratory, in the late 50s, early 60s, built something called the Top Sounder Satellite. It was a satellite that was launched into orbit. The satellite was a small radar system that bounced signals down to the ionosphere and back and measured the amount of reflection. Well, the topside sounder told you what the upper layer of the ionosphere looked like. The ordinary ionospheric sounders we have on the Earth tells you what the bottom side looks like. And by the way, they look fairly similar, as I remember. But there was a slight difference. So by radio waves bouncing off the ionosphere at various frequencies, you can measure an awful lot of those characteristics without even going there. You can measure the noise, the absorption. In other words, you could look at a particular radio star that you know the amount of power coming out of that star by radio astronomy measurements. And from day to day, you could look at the absorption of the ionosphere at those particular radio wavelengths that you know are coming out of that star. You could.
Well, what is the frequency?
Frequency? Oh, can I jump on this one, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead.
One thing really neat about plasmas, Wesley, is that they can be related to temperature as well. In other words, you can take one electron volt and divide it by Boltzmann's constant, and you can come up with actually a electron volt unit for temperature. So when you're viewing things and you want to take a electron volt to temperature measurement, it can tell you all different kinds of things. As a matter of fact, not only that, there's a magnetic confinement fusion equivalent that also is related to that one electron volt divided by Boltzmann's constant. And that actually comes out to some number like 170 megakelvins. So, in other words, you can look at distribution of temperature with Boltzmann's constant and come up with, different energy levels associated to temperature. So EV, Boltzmann's constant, in terms of temperature, will actually give you energy levels. So there's all kinds of interesting things. And then you're actually right on the borderline of electrophysics, because once you have that under your belt, then you can start looking at, photon properties. And then we put together a photon model where you can look at your, electron volts in volts per nanometer divided by its wavelength. And that's where the frequency comes in. And then once you have a frequency and you know your volts per nanometer with electron volts, then you can start coming up with a frequency spectrum. So you can do a whole bunch of interesting things by associating temperature and then adding frequency, and come up with all kinds of energy levels for photons in a plasma. It's a really beautiful science. Let me pass it back to you, Wesley. KC2QIQ.
Do you know by the chance what was the frequency of that small satellite radar that was doing measurement of the ionosphere? Back to you, Ben.
Yeah, the Topside Sounder satellite, I remember seeing pictures of it in the company brochure. It had four tape measures coming out of the four sides. These dipoles looked to me like they were, I'm going to make a guess, a 10-meter wavelength, roughly. Yeah. In other words, a half-wave dipole at 30 megacycles is something in the vicinity of 16 feet long. And that's approximately how big those dipoles were coming out of that satellite. So it was at HF frequencies, the upper end of the HF frequencies, was the ionospheric top sounder satellite built by Airborne Instruments Laboratory. You want to choose a frequency where the ionosphere really responds. If I went to 500 megacycles, a 500 megacycle signal goes through the ionosphere like it's not there. It's completely transparent. So depending on the level of ionization, that's what the maximum usable frequency is telling you. Depending on the level of ionization, higher and higher ionization allows a higher and higher frequency to be affected by an ionosphere. And frequencies above that, it looks transparent. And on the frequencies where it's not transparent, it has absorption and reflection characteristics, which can be measured with either a radar or a radio telescope. I'm going to have to leave you pretty soon. Back to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
WN.
Okay, yes. That is my Christmas present, or present from Santa, that I've got from you guys. My breaking station begun.
Okay, yeah, I don't think I've made access to the repeater, but Dick, I just have to tell you before, the Explorer, but it Van Allen belt.
Yeah, that was, I think, essentially the very first satellite launched by the United States after Sputnik, and the Explorer satellite had the right kind of instrumentation that literally measured the ionospheric ionization of what became the Van Allen belt, which is related to the ionosphere. The Van Allen belt is that belt of particles that are bouncing back and forth between the North Pole and the South Pole, and those particles are moving parallel to the Earth's magnetic field. That's what that Van Allen belt is. It's got a whole lot of particles bouncing back and forth. Those particles originally came from the solar wind. That's my understanding. These are charged particles moving in that magnetic field, and they're above the ionosphere. So you've got the Van Allen belt, which is that roughly, the Van Allen belt is roughly at, I think the number is 120 miles. Yep. I know that when you fly the astronauts, I take it back now, there's an inner Van Allen belt and an outer Van Allen belt. I know you've got a very difficult decision to make when you decide what altitude you're going to fly the astronauts when they're in orbit in the space shuttle or in the International Space Station. If you fly them too low, they're touching the ionosphere, touching the atmosphere and getting drag. You fly them a little bit higher, and they're being bombarded by the Van Allen belt, the radiation. And unless you've got a lot of nuclear hardening, you're going to be creating all kinds of damage to both the electronics and the biology on board. Let me drop.
Is it be below 300 or above 600?
Yeah, that sounds about right. As you fly higher, you get into the more and more dense areas of the Van Allen belt, and you want to avoid that for long-term exposure. So you're between a rock and a hard place when you choose the altitude for the International Space Station. Higher gives you more radiation, lower gives you more drag. And so they're flying it at, I think, something like 220 miles, which is sort of a compromise. When the Apollo astronauts went through the Van Allen belt to go to the moon, they were dwelling at that altitude for a very brief periods of time. They were moving at thousands of miles an hour, so it wasn't much of a problem. But you fly somebody in the International Space Station, it would be nice to put the International Space Station at, let me pick a number, 350 miles. It would have very little drag. But you'd be really cooking the astronauts if you did that. I believe that the electronics on board the Hubble Space Telescope is made as fairly hardened electronics that can tolerate the Van Allen belt radiation because it's at a much higher altitude. Because the International Space Station, let me drop. Because it's at a much lower altitude than desired, each individual mission of a international to the International Space Station by the space shuttle or by the Progress ships must do a little bit of boosting. In other words, each time you have a shipment of materials, replaceable, consumable materials to the space station, you also do some boosting to a higher orbit because it's continuously decaying. And if you ignored that for a long period of time, it would eventually be hitting more and more of the upper layers of the atmosphere, experiencing more and more drag, and it'd be a runaway condition. And you want to avoid that because it's a pretty valuable piece of hardware. Internationally, we've made a big investment to get it there, and you don't want to lose it. So you got a little bit of boosting all the time. And is it true, Paul, that each individual Progress ship also does some boosting? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yes, they do. That's true. And, of course, the shuttle, every time they do it, they bring it up about 14 miles every time the shuttle went up. Of course, the Progress isn't going to be able to do that. To bring fuel up, the space station does have thrusters on board to dump up a little bit. So, fueling pod that goes in the different cargo vehicles that will be going up there. They'll keep it up there. They won't let that orbit deteriorate. Not for the space station. That's been in the next 20 or 30 years.
Okay, there were quite a few dropouts, but I'm hearing Paul very loud on the input frequency on 146.25. And so Paul was telling us that the space shuttle boosts the International Space Station roughly 14 miles on each encounter. And you made it sound like the Progress ships, the Russian Progress ships, do some boosting, but nowhere near as much, not as much as 14 miles. Do you believe that the Progress ships will arrive often enough and do enough boosting to maintain the space station at the desired altitude? Roughly how much boosting does each Progress do, and will there be enough of those, or are we going to be falling a little bit shy? What's your opinion on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
I don't know how high our ships are capable of doing that, but also the Soyuz spacecraft, though, they have fuel on board, extra fuel that they'll the one that gets hit, same. Yeah. It was on every couple of months. So, you know, when the shuttle was grounded for all those years, you know, after, you know, they lost a couple of years for after Columbia, what happened was the Progress ships were the only ones doing that a little bit on the Soyuz. So they kept it, you know, they weren't losing ground. They were holding their own. But they always liked to give it a good blast with the shuttle.
Question number one, Paul, are you running full power with your antenna, the best antenna aimed at the repeater? We are hearing some occasional dropouts. I'm getting every word. And what roughly is the frequency at which the Progress ships arrive at the space station? Paul, go ahead.
Usually every 3 months. Yeah, I'm watching the SB to go up and down. It's propagation, I think. Something's happening there. Watching the SB to go up and down. So I'm running 55 watts out with a pushcraft 10 element beam pointing toward the North Shore Tower. So, you know, I'm popping on receiver, so I'm watching the meter go up and down, as you speak.
Paul, can I just ask a quick question? Is the strongest signal you're getting off your beam towards the North Shore Towers, or if you move it in other directions, can you receive the repeater stronger? Because tonight, my antenna is due north, and that's where I'm getting the best signal strength off the repeater, and I think I've got a pretty good signal into it tonight, but if I point at the repeater, it's absolutely awful. I'm going to pass it back to Dick, though. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, you appear to be dead full quieting. That's amazing, you're aimed to the north. I wonder if you've tried that ball. WS2N, K2RIW.
I heard at that.
Bye-bye, you all. See you down the log, K2RIW.
And 73 Stick, before you go, just a quick thing to mention. Tonight, sidebands from almost all communications tonight. If I just point my antenna north, I'm getting everything on every band. It's working like almost like an omnidirectional antenna. And everything is working beautiful, just pointing the antenna north. Never seen this condition before, ever. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What's the lowest frequencies you've used to the north and saw this effect, Glenn?
Tonight, just 2 meters. All the other bands seem to be working normally. It's just 2 meters that's doing this. And I said it's like, and it's not all the way down at 144. I wish it was, because at 144 is where there's more sideband activity. But we were playing a game and trying a sideband experiment before in the Simplex arena, and it was amazing that it was working there, and it was just very, very long distances as well, much better than FM. But there again, pointing antennas north. Why north? I don't know. But I know I'm not the only one experiencing this. I was just wondering if there was anybody else in the tech that was seeing it as well.
I tried it, Glenn, WS1. I tried it. I went north at about half a mile. And I went back, but not all the way. Now I'm northwest. I'm a little bit further north than I normally am now, Glenn.
That's a much better signal. What do you think, Glenn?
Paul, that is remarkable improvement. I'm just wondering if you go a little bit further north, how we would hear you on receive, because the funny thing is that there is the 600 kilohertz offset, and there, even though the receive might be a little bit lower when you go north, I'm wondering how you, if you would even be stronger into the repeater.
Well, I'll try it. You know, I figured let me roll the dice here. I was able to go, right now I'm like northwest, but normally I'm further to the west, in fact, a little bit southwest. I'm going to go north, going north. I'm probably due north now. No, I'm going to lose the repeater. I'm going to go back. Back to the northwest position.
Northwest was good. In between northwest and north, you had a little bit of a dropout, and you came back at north, not as strong. And by the way, when you aim to the northwest, and I'm listening to you on the input, I'm getting a 60 over 9. You're pegging my needle when you're aimed away from me to the northwest. You and I are almost east-west of each other. When you aim to the northwest, you go from S8 to pegging my needle. Paul, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that there's some kind of a difference because, you know, sometimes I'll go on the input and I'll swing that antenna all the way. By the way, that, you know, on the eastern input, that thing's been down all night. But when I do that, you know, I mean, I'll point north and I don't see any kind of a signal when I go north normally. Tonight, I mean, it comes up to half scale, a little bit better than half scale. So yeah, there's something weird about the north, but just nowhere near as good as northwest. Where normally I'm just west, or just actually a little southwest to, you know, for this repeater deck.
Fantastic. The are you running a vertically polarized Yagi or a horizontally polarized Yagi, Paul?
Vertically polarized, 10 element. And it's mounted to an Alliance HD73 rotator, so it's a pretty sturdy rotator for that type of beam.
And I presume your vertically polarized Yagi is mounted directly against a metallic mast, and you didn't worry about it, which is a perfectly good thing to do. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a homebrew pipe tower. I sawed off a 3-inch pipe and go down to 2-inch. I used to have it up about 30 feet. Now I'm only up about 17 feet. I lowered a little bit. Too much to work on. The older I get, the shorter the tower's getting, I think. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, what I'm asking, though, is the mast that the antenna is mounted to, is that a vertical mast going through the middle of the Yagi, so to speak? Go ahead.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes, cue us up.
So, in other words, you just ignored that mast, and the antenna's working like a charm. Is that true?
I'm trying to really get the question. In other words, I'm coming up with I got the rotator, and above the rotator, I've got a small piece of pipe, and that's where the antenna is bumped with the U-clamp, vertically polarized. That's the setup.
A vertically polarized beam, a vertical mast going through the middle of the beam. That's where your hardware is mounted. And so, does the mast that's in the middle of the beam, that it's mounted to, that it's screwed down to, does that extend above the boom? And if so, how far? Go ahead.
Yeah, that probably extends about 6 inches. About 6 inches. And I just got a pipe cap on top of that, with Teflon tape.
Hey, Jake, I've got another little tidbit for you.
Go ahead.
Okay, with, 13 elements on 2 meter horizontal right now, I get my strongest signal southwest, more due south than west. And I'm getting a similar effect as I do vertical, almost directly due north. Is that something? It's a beautiful thing. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
In the case of a horizontal beam, you get all kinds of crazy patterns when you're cross-polarized. Technically, those are called Condon lobes, C-O-N-D-O-N, because the guy had a footnote in the original Rad Lab book, number 12, I think it is, by Silver, 1948, McGraw-Hill, Radiation Laboratory, the microwave antenna book that was part of the World War II developments. Mr. Condon calculated what the lobes look like. You get a very different antenna pattern when you're cross-polarized. And so that's part of what I think you're seeing. I got to leave you guys. It's been fun. Bye-bye for now.
Okay. And Glenn, what's your QTH? I don't have my computer on.
Yeah, let me say 73 is Dick. Enjoy yourself. Have a wonderful week and a very happy new year until I can speak to you next time, unless I can catch you sometime during the week. I'm off this week. And, Paul, I'm actually located in Massapequa on the South Shore, directly due south of Route 107. So I'm actually south of Merrick Road, all the way down by the water.
Okay, very good, Glenn. And 73, Dick. Have a good night. Get you during the week or week. Next week is New Year. Okay, Glenn, hey. Going like northwest. Off in, you know, north of you and northwest of me.
It's very interesting propagation here tonight. But I think I'm going to be signing off as well, because I've been kind of like running out towards the front door there and the side doors, just trying to keep the snow from building up around there. I'm not even bothering to dig out tonight. I'll wait till the storm finishes tomorrow. So I'm in no real rush to go anywhere. I've got off all this week. So I'm going to say 73 is to you now, Paul. Have yourself a really wonderful week and a happy new year. And I'm not sure who else is listening, if Wesley's still out there and he's listening, or anybody else. To everyone else, have yourself a wonderful week and a very happy new year. This is KC2, QIQ, saying 73 is to all. Have a good one.
7. We have plenty in the weather tomorrow. KC2 QIQ WS2N will be clear. Somebody else, I think, doubled with you. I think somebody else doubled with me. I don't know who it was left for you.
Yeah, actually, I was doubling with you guys. I wish you guys a happy new year, and also thank you, Eric, for your job. You were silent today, but you're doing a lot, and you were doing a lot during that year, 2010, for keeping this technet alive. Eric is still there. John. Are you there?
We're all gone, Wesley. 73. Have a good night. Have a good year. Up, U.S.
Thank you very much. Thank you, John.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio repeater system. Good morning. The time is 12:50 a.m. You are currently connected to Reflector 9126.
Time is 2:52 a.m. Good morning.
KB2 SID testing.
Set tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Morning. Time is 3:35 a.m. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system. 2 the W2VL repeater. Good morning. Time is 4:45 a.m.
KC2RKK. Listening. 1, 2, 5.
Morning. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system.
KC2RKK. 1, 2, 5.
The time is 5:10 a.m. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Good morning.
KC2RKK, listening on 1, 2, 5.
The time is 5:20 a.m. Good morning. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. W2VL repeater system. The time is 5:34 a.m. Good morning. The time is 5:47 a.m. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
KC2, Foxtrot Mike November, listening. KC2, FMN, listening.
Amateur radio.